Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Let's talk markets here and kind of where we go from here. What should we expect maybe from this Federal Reserve next week after we've had this move by the ECB? Bring in Jay Hatfield. He's the CEO, founder, and portfolio manager at Infrastructure Capital Advisors. And Jay, let's just start with Europe and the ECB. I mean, they're still, like the U.S. Federal Reserve, still very much on this inflation-fighting path, raising their benchmark rate by 50 basis points, where a lot of people said maybe pause, maybe just 25, but no.
Thanks, Paul, for having me in again. You have to keep in mind the European system is radically different than the U.S. So they were way behind our Fed, full percentage point behind our Fed. And also their inflation is worse because of their natural gas crisis. It's come down, but it's still a huge problem. And then thirdly, all their banks are essentially money center banks. Like our money center banks are killing it right now. They're getting all these deposits in. And keep in mind that that's free money right now. So that's the real problem with our system, is that smaller banks are losing deposits. And that's every dollar that goes out costs them roughly 5%. So you're paying 50 basis points or zero if it's a demand deposit. And then you borrow from the Fed at LIBOR plus a spread. And so their earnings are getting smashed as we speak. And that's the core issue. And that's why we've been calling for a rate cut to reduce that the inversion in the yield curve.
So when you compare that to then what the Federal Reserve is doing, the read-through, I think one of the takeaways from the ECB is simply that they hiked regardless of the chaos for Credit Suisse. If Credit Suisse is a bigger bank and a bigger risk than, say, SVB is, which I think is the consensus, then does that then insinuate the Federal Reserve is going to stick to 25 or 50 or whatever the calls were pre-SVB?
Well, that's certainly possible because they have shown zero ability to process real-time data. So, and specifically, I would point to oil, which is something that we
focus coming on. From Jay Hatfield, live on broadcast.
So the two key indicators of inflation are housing and oil. Oil has come down 17% since the financial crisis started, the bank run started. And what I don't think the Fed appreciates, which is strange because they have research papers that demonstrate this, there's a 5% bleed through of energy prices to core. In fact, if you look in the 70s and draw a line where the two gigantic increases occurred, so 200 and 150, core went up, shot up within 3 or 4 months. So this is not, this research paper just proved it, through econometric models, but you can see it in the data. So now we have a significant deflation. CPI-R is dropping at a 2% annual rate. And now if you layer in this depreciation in oil, we're headed for a pretty significant deflation. I mean, essentially, we're in deflation right now. It's just not going to show up in the indices for a year because they're lagged by a year.
So, you know, do you think this banking situation here in the U.S., this run on these handful of banks, will prompt the Fed, or should it prompt the Fed to pause here? If not, maybe be a little
absolutely
bit more
aggressive. Pause. That's what they should. Well, they should really cut.
Right.
But they are behind almost every market participant would agree they're behind the curve. So the best case is probably that they pause. They definitely should not raise rates. That would be a disaster. And again, they're in a much different situation where they were already raised much higher, and we have a bigger inversion than they do in Europe.
Jay, one of the piece of commentary that came out of, I believe, Nomura off the Fed FDIC move this past weekend was that's essentially stimulative. And you might then see the Fed end quantitative tightening as a result. Do you view this kind of banking fallout and what has the Fed has been prompted to do as stimulative?
Well, it, in the long run, it will be stimulative. And that's one reason, like we were saying before this banking crisis, that the market would be weak during this period and that we would be in 3,800 to 4,200. That's without a banking crisis.
Yeah.
So the fact that that range is still working is remarkable. But there's a simple reason for it. Long-term rates are plummeting. And it's not actually true, but everybody trades tech stocks like they have a longer duration. They actually don't, but they still trade it that way. They're all publicly traded companies roughly have 22-year durations. But they're also a safe haven. They don't borrow money. They have tremendous cash reserves. And they're very powerful companies. So they're being used as safe haven. They dominate the market. So if you look, there's an enormous rotation into large cap tech, safety, and out of things that are related to financials, including REITs, which is irrational because rates are dropping. That's good for them. They're well capitalized. So that's why the market's not crashing. But underneath it, it really is crashing. Like if you look at the regional banks, for obviously.
What, from your perspective, what are we seeing with these regional banks, the SVBs, the maybe even the FRC today, the Signature Bank? Are these one-offs or they have a systemic background to them, do you think?
Well, I think it's not fully systemic because, as I mentioned, money center banks and super regionals are going to benefit. And that's the dominant portion of the banking system. But, and this is going to be an issue for politicians, hopefully, is that their banks are getting crushed. So the community banks and the regular regional banks, because if you think about a CFO, so there's sort of an implicit guarantee, but it's kind of like the commercial sort of is not good enough.
Yep.
So if you're CFO and a bank, I won't mention any names, certain bank closes, like my CFO called me and said, hey, should we move all of our reserves? Because you have to make that call because you're going to be fired. If you said, oh, yeah, I know Silicon Valley Bank happened, but we thought the FDIC would step in and they decided not to for political reasons, you're fired. So you have to move your reserves, your checking, spread it out, and you're going to move it to super, you probably don't want 50 or 500 accounts, so you're going to move it to a money center bank, where then you're not going to get fired. Like if Citigroup goes bankrupt, you're not going to get fired. So there's going to be an ongoing run on small banks. It's a huge problem because they're going to become unprofitable. They're going to get downgraded by the rating agencies, which Silicon Valley's demise, along with the worst equity offering ever executed in human history. I'm certain there's never been an equity offering that resulted in bankruptcy.
Right.
Like you don't need to do a post meeting to see if that was a good.
That sounds like a Morgan Stanley banker pitching against Goldman Sachs.
Don't say that too loudly.
No picking on any particular firms, but right. That is the worst equity offering in the history of humankind.
Well, quick question here, and forgive my ignorance on this. That doesn't necessarily seem like a new concept here. Naturally, that if you want the bigger banks are going to be safer because essentially they're too big to fail, especially since 2008. Why did a lot of folks invest in these smaller banks anyway? What's the incentive there?
Well, I think that there's also too much heat being put on the San Francisco Fed because no stress test ever said you're going to lose all of your deposits in 24 hours.
Yeah.
There's never been a situation like that. Even like during the financial crisis, we did guarantee the deposits. So we created a system by accident where having this 250 limit, which hasn't been increased, and there have been bills to increase it, really created a tinderbox that exploded. It's just like the mortgage market. There's always something that hasn't been addressed that a too rapid Fed tightening cycle will expose. And there's been like 10 of them even in my career. You know, if you think about junk bond crisis, SNL crisis, commercial real estate crisis in the early 80s, there's always, tech crash after that tightening cycle. Mm-hmm. So this is just the flaw that should have been fixed, should have guaranteed all deposits. It won't even cost so much because you can have a lower rate on more deposits. So it would hurt the money center banks and it would benefit the regional banks.
All right. So what do you think folks should be doing in the market today? There's a lot of cross currents here with the Fed, with this banking crisis, if you will. Is this just stay on the sidelines here? Because I'm looking at the market here, and it's kind of hanging in there.
Yeah, so that's the rotation going on. So I'm sure I have the S&P up, but I'm sure the tech stocks are starting to rip and offset the
weakness. Yeah, NASDAQ's up a little bit here.
Yeah, right. So I do think that ultimately this is bullish, because assuming the Fed, but I would wait to have the Fed pause, not raise rate, and hopefully good commentary about even being willing to cut. And then that will take the key overhang on the market, which I've said before on your shows, is that as the Fed, because they were just completely out to lunch and thought it was fine to raise rates at this unprecedented level. So now, because the Fed regulates banks, they can't ignore it. You know, they're getting the calls from the FDIC, they're getting the calls from Congress. And so it's not like CSFB that none of our, you know, our politicians. So they have to focus on this, and presumably they will consider rate increases. There won't be at their normal level of being behind by about 12 months. They can't afford to be behind 12 months here. They have to cut rates more quicker than that.
Well, doesn't that factor in things like any of the retail data, any of the Chinese story, any of the eco stuff that we, I feel like, have been paying attention to as these tailwinds for inflation in the face of this banking fallout? Does the rest matter?
Not really, no. That's why it's important to focus on those two elements that drove inflation. I'm talking high inflation, by the way, not one versus two versus three.
Yeah.
Is housing, 42% of core. And energy is only 6. And keep in mind, natural gas prices are at 80% in the last 4 months. Highly deflationary. But every business in the United States uses energy. And so that's the key supply shock. It's not necessarily the ports or chips. I mean, chips was a problem because you can't build cars. But those are the key drivers, and you should look at oil. It's both an indicator of inflation, and it's also an indicator of the potential for a global recession.
Jay, we can't let you go without getting kind of your thoughts on energy right here. I see WTI crude oil down again today. We're at $66 a barrel. What's kind of the next 12, 18 months? What are you looking for in the energy space?
Well, before the financial crisis, we were at 75 to 95 on WTI, because you do have a recovery in China. You do have a pretty robust U.S. economy, which is shocking, but it's because of the pandemic. And you still do have an energy crisis, or at least an energy deficit in Europe. So those are all supportive factors. But investors treat oil as a risk asset, and this is a risk-off environment, so you're going to crash well below our level. And so it's all bets are off until we get clarity on the Fed and possibly maybe a guarantee of all deposits. I mean, that's going to be hard to get through Congress, but that's what's needed.
All right, Jay, great stuff. Really appreciate it. As always, Jay Hatfield, CEO, founder, and portfolio manager at Infrastructure Capital Advisors, joining us live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
All right, let's get back over to Europe a little bit, get a sense of kind of what the feeling is here with the ECB, with Credit Suisse. We could do that with Dr. Vanya Stravyakova, professor of economics at the London Business School. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us here. Let's start with the European Central Bank. They came out with a 50 basis point increase. Given all that's going on over there with the banking situation, and namely Credit Suisse, do you think that was a mistake? Should they have paused or maybe just raised the rate 25 basis points? What do you think?
So thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think actually they did the right thing. Given the numbers for inflation, they have to establish credibility at this point. And I think the main concern in Europe right now is to get inflation under control. I'm less worried about solvency issues with the banks in Europe at this point. And I think they probably are thinking the same way. Of course, there will be liquidity issues on the horizon, which is what we are seeing with Credit Suisse, potentially other banks, but they're ready to provide a backstop. For example, the Swiss National Bank did the same for Credit Suisse. Of course, ECB can do that for the Eurozone banks. So I think treating it at the moment as a liquidity rather than a solvency crisis is the right approach. Regulation is quite strict, especially for the large banks in Europe. So Credit Suisse is very well regulated. For example, you know, the one correct thing that was done by Switzerland and also the UK was ring fencing the retail banking of the large banks. So both the UK and Switzerland realized after the global financial crisis that these countries do not have the fiscal capacity to bail out their massive banks. So ring fencing the retail bank, which is essential for the functioning of the economy, essentially is giving them the freedom to not worry too much about having to put in massive bailouts. And then liquidity can be dealt with in many ways, such as providing loans against the face value of the collateral, which is what the Fed started doing, so that they don't have to worry about the decrease in the valuations of long-term government debt.
Professor, I'm curious about the timeline here. It feels like this banking fallout, to your point, to Paul's point as well, has kind of thrown the idea of the energy crisis, this kind of multi-year recession we were expecting in the UK, out the window. To what extent are those still the factors that the BOE and the ECB have to be watching?
Well, so the problems in the UK are separate because they have to deal with the consequences of Brexit as well, mismanagement of the economy for many, many years, sadly. So we are seeing that in the news, the public sector is collapsing in the UK. We are seeing strikes daily in the news. So those issues are not going away. Those are structural issues that governments will have to deal with. But getting inflation under control is absolutely crucial, because if we think that high interest rates are a problem for the banking sector, imagine having high interest rates for a very long period of time because we cannot get inflation under control. Potentially, the problems will be even more severe, particularly for the mortgages, of course. So Europe and the UK, the majority of the mortgages are floating rate mortgages. And that's where the real problem will be, because a lot of the borrowers might not be able to soon start repay their mortgages, and that will generate a recession down the road. So the longer the high interest rates remain, which they will if we don't get inflation under control, the bigger the cost on anyone that has a mortgage in Europe and the UK, and that's where the real recession is going to come.
We're getting a little bit of news. I just want to announce to our international audience here, JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley in talks to bolster First Republic. This, of course, was the next bank that was expected to kind of get taken down with Signature, with Silicon Valley Bank. This is according to reports from the Wall Street Journal. You are seeing FRC, those shares, pair some of those losses, still down 26%, but certainly off the lows of down about 30%. Professor Vanya, I want to bring you back in here, not to talk about First Republic, but perhaps a similar situation with Credit Suisse as well. Do the woes in the European banking sector go away if someone takes over parts of Credit Suisse?
Well, so the problem with Credit Suisse is effectively they could never gain their footing after the global financial crisis. They couldn't figure out what type of bank they will be, in the sense that they were a massive bank. The asset management division and the wealth management divisions were a big part of the bank. However, they're not competitive. The fees that they were charging couldn't compete with the BlackRocks and the Vanguards of the world, and essentially the decrease in fees due to the advancement of ETFs. So I think that's a structural problem. So more generally, people compare the stampede of depositors from banks now to a classic bank run. I think that's not correct. So the fundamental problem here is not about having deposit insurance that's not credible or insufficient deposit insurance, as governments are clearly willing to back depositors in full, as the Fed has shown. It's about final investors waking up and realizing there are alternatives to bank deposits that can give them both liquidity and much higher return. The banking sector will have to shrink. So Credit Suisse has been experiencing that through the asset management division, but this will be true for your standard depositors as well, because many banks will not be able to afford to offer high interest rates on depositors, right? So this is because on their assets, then they will not be able to make the interest rates that depositors can make just by purchasing debt, government debt at this point. I think that's the big problem. And the trend of bank disintermediation had already started, and the rate hikes together with the SVB collapse and the negative news around Credit Suisse are just precipitating the adjustment. Yes, there'll be some casualties along the way, but the old bank business model is simply not sustainable in the new environment where even small retail investors can open a Vanguard account overnight and invest in government debt that pays positive rates. So now, to be honest, yeah?
No, go ahead, Professor.
What I'm particularly concerned about, and I don't hear it being spoken about enough in the news, is essentially there is someone on the other end of these interest rate hedges. So the interest rate derivatives market is the most liquid market in the world, essentially. So presumably a lot of financial institutions and banks are hedging duration risk. But who is providing this hedge? So we know that this ended up very badly for AIG in 2008 because they were the sellers of insurance for the mortgage-backed securities. If the risk is concentrated and there are a few entities actually providing the interest rate hedge, then I think this will be the casualties this time. We don't know yet where the risk is concentrated, which is a big problem, I think, for regulators.
Okay, so Professor, just kind of getting back to the ECB here, I mean, the risk, you know, we've heard a lot of folks say, hey, the ECB is making a mistake here. They need the pause. And not necessarily just for the Credit Suisse reason, but for some of the reasons you outlined about, there's some real stresses out there in the economy, and then the ECB really risks breaking the European economy and pushing into a deep recession. How viable are those risks, do you think?
Well, it is true that people are arguing that they might be going at a pace that is too fast. I think they are doing the right thing to defend their credibility, and whatever the issues there might be with the financial sector, which I do believe there will be issues, as we discussed, they can handle them in different ways. So they have a lot of macroprudential tools. It's not just interest rates that they can employ in order to handle any instabilities in the financial sector. And it's almost like time to give the patient the medicine it needs, because the longer we postpone normalization, going back to normal interest rates, these adjustments have to take place at some point.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Vania Stravyakova, Professor of Economics at the London School of Business. We really appreciate getting her time. She's got some cutting-edge research on the banking sector, and it's just absolutely at the forefront here as the European regulators and the Swiss regulators look at Credit Suisse and what to do there. All right, let's get back to the story that just broke over the last few minutes, Wall Street Journal reporting, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and others in talks to aid First Republic. I mean, this is so obvious. I can't imagine these bankers are actually going to get paid, this investment bankers for putting this deal together. I could do this. But let's bring in some of our banking experts, Herman Chang and Arnold Kakuta. Arnold covers the credit side, and Herman kind of more on the equity side so we got you covered when it comes to these banks. Herman, to me, what do you make of this news? It kind of makes complete sense to me. This is if they're going to put capital in or outright buy parts or all of, that seems like an easy deal to do.
Yeah, I think so. We still think FRC, First Republic, is a really strong franchise with a lot of wealth management assets that are attractive to a potential buyer. And really, it's been sucked into the vortex with some of the uncertainty that proliferated with SVB and Signature. But the capital infusion news is definitely great news for the bank and management, so we're looking to hear more on that front.
All right, Arnold, come on in here. We just had Allison Williams on in the last hour. We're talking about this deal, and she said, look, this isn't an acquisition. This is a lifeline that might not help the stock and bond investors. Well, is it going to help the bond investors at all? Do they care?
Well, I mean, in terms of the, we had some big downgrades yesterday from like, A-, BBB+ to, high yield.
Yeah.
Big deal. But they only had $800 million of bonds.
This is what we call a fallen angel.
Right? But I mean, relatively speaking, it's pretty small, and they have about like $3.5 billion of preferred. So I think the risk is contained for a lot of the investors. But definitely, markets moving on all these defaults happening really rapidly. Credit Suisse, But, you know, like you guys have been talking about, this is a great franchise. But I think, you know, the headlines could be misleading in the sense of, you know, the crown jewel here is this wealth management business. And so, and from that aspect, you know, even a JP Morgan, who's kind of prohibited from buying any deposit franchises, they can kind of look at the wealth franchise and say, hey, you know, Morgan Stanley, that's the crown jewel. You can acquire, you know, wealth management assets. So and that, you know, wealth management assets, you know, kind of spit off fees, and that kind of stable business is great that anybody would love to have.
We did have some, or we're seeing some credit downgrades, Arnold. If I'm Moody's or Fitch or whatever it is, what are the two or three metrics I really look at when I think about moving my rating?
Yeah, so I think, you know, looking at kind of what has transpired and the risks of uninsured deposits possibly flowing out, and based on kind of the fears that are out there, right? I think that that's what why they made these moves, I guess, preemptively for First Republic, given kind of all the headlines out there. You know, I think looking at the stock reactions and people, you know, seeing the uncertainty of, you know, what happened with the uninsured deposits of Silicon Valley Bank on Friday and Monday, right? You know, a lot of the damage may have already been done.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, and so that's why when you see these news things about like, oh, we tapped extra liquidity from the Fed, FDIC, oh, JP Morgan's extending us credit line, it's like, oh my God, you know, it's that whole thing of like, why are you saying that if there isn't a problem, right? So,
well, Herman, hop back on in here because we're talking about First Republic, obviously, in this capital infusion, but another peer that is trading the stock in terms of is trading tick by tick is Western Alliance.
Right.
WAL, folks, is the ticker there. This is the company that recently got a 5.3% stake from Ken Griffin of Citadel that mm-hmm. we know, which in its own way is its own capital infusion. What kind of numbers are we looking at here? I mean, Allison was very careful about saying, look, First Republic is not being acquired yet.
Right.
Will it be? Are we looking for a potential stake still, or is this kind of lifeline going to be enough?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question at this point. Does the stake by potentially JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley stabilize the market fears and stabilize the deposit outflow? If those two things happen, then you know that would be great news. In terms of Western Alliance, it's another bank that operates in the Western part of the United States, and they have branches in California, in Arizona, and Nevada, and does have some exposure to the venture and startup community, but it's very small relative to what SVB did, which is the entirety of their business. So they are unfortunately lumped into the same situation, and not having some of the duration risk that SVB had. So there's unfortunately they get thrown into the mix.
All right, I'm going to throw this out for either of you two or both of you, whatever you want to do. I could care less. All I want to, because I'm trying to figure out, and I think a lot of investors are trying to figure out, how systemic is this bank issue? We're all still scarred from 2008 when everybody got pulled into it. When the Fed raises rates by like 500 basis points within a year, what does that mean for a bank?
Sure. What's it mean for a bank is that some banks get caught offsides. They weren't expecting such a rapid rise in rates, and they get caught offsides.
What's it mean to get caught offside?
You purchase securities or you do loans at a very low rate environment and aggressively, and when rates rise, the value of those assets decline. And when there's a loss in confidence in a bank, that can just spur a lot of uncertainty. The market, you know, the share price declines, and that's really essentially what happened with SVB.
All right, we'll hop back on in here, Arnold, and talk to us a little bit about where we go from here. I mean, you already mentioned that we have seen this wave of downgrades, these wave of kind of distress for some of these banks. Are you seeing this show up in, say, the hedges or the insurance, the CDSs, against some of these banks?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen spreads widen first on this SVB, and then Credit Suisse, you know, a lot more. And, and you know, one metric we look at kind of in the corporate bond space is, you know, the financials, how do they trade versus the overall corporate bond index?
Sure.
And, you know, they had widened out in 2022 until October, and then we rallied back almost to flat. And then obviously now they're trading about 25 wider again. But I think it's going to be tough for the financials to kind of regain that, you know, unless the markets really calm down. I think it's going to be tough, you know, for the financials to kind of tighten back up again compared to the overall index, given kind of the default risk, which is real.
Yeah. So we were talking about systemic risk broadly, but let's talk about the bond space specifically. In terms of contagion, in terms of trading and sympathy, are you seeing the Credit Suisse situation bleed into kind of the regional bank situation? Because in my mind, they're two separate issues.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So, you know, with the regional bank stuff, I think, you know, for the select regional banks that are having issues, you know, it was like, okay, maybe the bigger U.S. banks, the biggest U.S. banks, like the JPMs, B of A's, that's kind of like a safe haven. But then when you deal with Credit Suisse and kind of the interconnectedness to the counterparties and all this and that, then it's like, okay, well then the bigger banks are kind of more exposed to that. Yeah. Although we haven't really seen it in the pricing yet. You know, if something were to happen, I think, you know, that's where you're going to be like, you know, who has kind of the most ties to kind of a, you know, global systemically important entity? Oh, it might be the trading desks, and oh, they might be counterparts here and there. Although, at least Credit Suisse, you know, they had been kind of shrinking their trading platform, right? So maybe the risks are more contained there. But if anything, you know, you got to start looking at the biggest banks again in terms of kind of the systemic contagion risks from Credit Suisse.
And on the regional side, the contagion and the systemic risks and the interconnectivity really isn't there. So that risk should be off the table on the regional bank side.
So, Herman, on the regional bank side, if I were an analyst, and I know about, you know, 15 minutes of experience in this, what percentage of a bank's deposits are insured on average?
Yeah, it really runs the gamut.
And I can just screen on that, right?
Yeah, you can screen on that. You have to dig deep into the regulatory filings, but you could theoretically do it because I know you're a smart person. I would say that it runs the gamut. SVB was about 5%. Signature was about 10%.
So you want, as an investor, I want as high a percentage as possible.
Correct, because
And that they were low because they had these big deposits, well above 250.
Big commercial deposits.
Gotcha. Okay.
And
see
you
how
want
much
them.
I'm learning here.
Yeah, he's got 15 minutes. I got 10. Together, it's 25.
Exactly. So you want them high
but
uninsured
how about
deposits.
Your former employer, M&T Bank. What was their insured deposit?
It's roughly? More about the 50% or around that level.
Yep. See, that's what I'm looking for. See, why can't I just screen on that? I'm sure I can on the Bloomberg terminal. And I buy the good ones and I sell the bad ones.
That sounds like a very good idea.
But I presume that with Silicon Valley Bank, I'm willing to take that deposit risk. I just called it deposit risk. I don't know what you guys call it. Why do I take that deposit risk?
Because you were not expecting a deposit flight because, you know, a week ago, the strength of the institution was the venture capital relationships and the startup relationships that became a weakness when there was a loss in confidence.
Boy, I could now be a banks analyst there. I think I've learned so much.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Paul Sweeney here with Kriti Gupta. Matt Miller out today. We've been focusing on testimony from Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen. She is testifying in front of Congress. We started off the day with some news out of the European Central Bank raising the benchmark rate by 50 basis points, and there were calls for maybe a pause, maybe just a 25 basis point increase, if for no other reason than to just cool the markets, given some of the turmoil we've seen in there with the banking sector. Let's go back to Europe and get a sense of kind of how the market's dealing with it today. Marianne Squidell, founder of Bougainville Consulting, joins us. Marianne, I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of what you believe or kind of your takeaways from Christine Lagarde's 50 basis point move at the ECB.
Yes. Well, you know, I used to work as a regulator a very long time ago. And what I'm hearing from my previous colleagues is that the regulators are quite confident that the banking sector is a little bit stronger in Europe because they didn't relax the rules, you know, on mid-sized lenders. So, and the stress test, they're confident that they're strong enough. And so I think there's this sense in Europe at the moment. I think that's my take on it. Obviously, nobody knows what's going to happen, and it's obviously a question of confidence at this stage.
So, you know, the backdrop of some concerns, obviously major concerns at Credit Suisse, how do you think that played into the ECB's decision here? Because there are a lot of people saying, boy, if you take a look at some of the potential wider risk from continued challenges at Credit Suisse, that in and of itself might suggest that they pause.
So I don't know. But, you know, in the UK, we still have this memory of, like, there was even before the financial crisis in 2007, there was a run on a bank, which I don't know in the US if you heard much about it. It was Northern Rock. It was a big lender. And we saw in the streets of London people lining up to get their money back. And that was something major. So the government in the UK, in the European Union, it's maybe a bit different. But in the UK, which at the time was part of the European Union, obviously, so in the UK, you know, the government worked throughout the weekend. There's HSBC that bought SVB for £1. And I have a friend who invests in a startup. The startup decided to stay a client of SVB. And they feel, from a client's perspective, a deposit taker's perspective, they are feeling fairly reassured. And the sentiment at the moment is not as panicky as you know it may be. So that may have played a part, obviously, in the decision of the central bank.
So, Marianne, you know, I'm a former employee at Credit Suisse, so I'm paying very close attention there. A lot of things that I think a lot of us learned during the financial crisis is, particularly for these investment banks, is counterparty risk, and that concept that, boy, if the market doesn't have confidence in your institution, it is game over. I don't care who you are and what the name is on the door. How do you assess that risk for Credit Suisse at this point?
That's a very good question. It's really too early to tell, I think. It's a very good question. We don't know. That's the answer.
Right.
We don't know.
All right. So what's the next step here for the central bank, do you believe, in Frankfurt?
Well, I don't know what they're going to decide, of course, but at the moment, everybody is kind of weighing up the pros and cons, you know, of what's going to happen. But as you said, it's a question of confidence.
Right.
If, you know, if depositors stay put, you know, there's the risk, the inflation becomes obviously more of a priority. Otherwise, it would be, you know, the confidence of deposit takers that is a priority.
All right, Marianne, thank you so much. We appreciate getting some of your time. Marianne Squidell, founder of Bougainville Consulting. We started off the day, with the ECB, really focusing on Christine Lagarde. The ECB, they stayed true to what they were saying, a 50 basis point move. So whenever we get news out of the Bank of England or the ECB, there are two people we have to talk to. Marcus Ashworth, boom, we ticked that off this morning on Bloomberg Surveillance, and John Authors. These are two cranky Brits who, if they've got something to say, they don't mind saying it, folks. John, what do you make of Christine Lagarde, that European Central Bank's 50 basis points move? Don't we have the risk of a recession? Don't we have a big bank that's in trouble? What's going on?
Well, I'm not feeling that cranky just at this moment, just to get that on the record. And it's also rather wonderful just watching Bloomberg Technology on Bloomberg TV at the moment, where for some reason we have two cranky Brits introducing a show about American
curmudgeonly
technology.
Let's go
yes,
with that.
Curmudgeonly, yeah, I like that. I like that. I might go with being a curmudgeon, if not a crank.
Right.
In terms of what the ECB has done, they have, you know, they have a dilemma, and they've decided to go all out on the belief, A, that inflation really matters and it isn't beaten yet, and B, and this is the critical one, that you can separate the functions of fighting inflation and maintaining financial stability. Certainly, it ought to be the case if Credit Suisse's issue and of the different banks that have fallen in this country is if that issue is merely liquidity as opposed to solvency, then they should be safe, they should be within their rights to carry on tightening rates. That said, the fact I personally gasped when the news came this morning, and I think plenty of other people have done as well. It is pretty seriously courageous that they've pressed ahead with this. They are very strongly signalling that they don't think the banking sector is in that much trouble. And, you know, courageous is not always something you want to be as a central banker.
But just what measure do they come up with that conclusion that the banking sector is not in that much of a crisis?
Well, if you look at priced book multiples, which I did in my column last night, for the Eurozone banks, yeah, they're trading below book, but they've been trading below book value for 15 years. And there's really nothing particularly crisis-ridden or scary about the trading in those banks. In fact, in the actual share price, given the greatest risk here is buying the stock in one of these banks rather than taking out a deposit. Plainly, shareholders are at much greater risk of being wiped out than depositors. Oddly enough, we are still not showing as much stress as either 08 or 11-12, which for the European banks was actually in many ways a bigger deal than 08 was.
And I think in 08 we all became experts on the TED spread. Can you give us the dummy's explanation for that?
The TED spread.
Where that is?
The TED spread is the comparison between the short-term rates at which banks lend to each other. Still, although LIBOR has had an interesting history in the years since the global financial crisis, it's what we think of as LIBOR. It's the rate at which they lend to each other, compared to the rate you can get on T-bills. So generally those two numbers are very close to each other and the banks are very slightly higher. When the spread rises, it indicates that banks really have a problem trusting each other. The TED spread at the moment is still unremarkable. The banks don't have any great degree of distrust with each other. There is a danger in taking 08, which most of us who lived through 08 find it difficult not to take 08 as a basis of comparison. What happened to the TED spread, what happened to banks' trust in each other in 08 was extreme because we've gone through all this. Just nobody knew who was sitting on the bad loans. They didn't even know whether they themselves were sitting on the bad loans, and trust was completely destroyed. There is nothing like 08 on the picture. The possibility that this is a liquidity problem that will require banks to put up with far less in the way of profits and will be part of a slowdown in the economy, that's a really serious issue. There really shouldn't be any risk of a true repetition of 2008. And again, I'm startled that they had the courage to go through with this, but perhaps the ECB view is by being deviated from the path they'd clearly spelt out before, they would have increased the risks that people would say, okay, the ECB is running scared. They must know something. We should run for the hills.
John, you mentioned your opinion piece. And folks, you can find that at Bloomberg.com/opinion or O-P-I-N. Go on the terminal. John's piece is entitled Move Along. There's no crisis to see here. Yeah.
Nerve-wracking headline, that exactly, one. But anyway, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Here in the United States, I would say the consensus is soft landing, no landing, something on those lines. Probably not a hard landing. Is it the same in Europe, would you say? Or it seems a little bit more precarious there.
I'm not sure the consensus is quite so clearly that we get a soft landing here that, as it was a couple of weeks ago. And if it is, I don't quite know why people are expecting rates to come down quite as aggressively as they do. In Europe, the situation is very much murkier because of this big extra factor of the energy crisis.
Yep.
So at one point that was a big reason to expect a really serious slowdown in economic activity this year, a perfectly reasonable one. And because the weather in Europe turns out to have been, I gather, 2 standard deviations better than you would normally expect, a really mild winter, that's had much less of a drastic impact than would have been expected. So the risk of a hard landing has moved out of the, well, it hasn't gone away, but it has reduced very significantly. And that in turn has increased the pressure on the ECB to be somewhat more hawkish than they were previously setting out to be. But that energy factor plus the way that the European financial system works through banks more than it does through markets, and its banks have never really totally recovered from what happened to it at the turn of the last decade. That does make the situation very different.
Usually it's the Fed that goes first, right? I mean, the timing of the calendar, this has the ECB going first. Does Jay Powell take any cue from Christine Lagarde this time around?
It makes it harder for him to pause altogether, I think, but we don't know what's going to happen in the next. You know, we've still got 4.5 days before the FOMC has to make its decision. Absent a significant new banking issue flaring up somewhere, and I have no opinion on what the probability of that is, but absent that, I think 25 basis points hike next week is very likely. We don't need to get into all of it. The data does not suggest that inflation on its own is still too high for them to stop hiking.
Then the folks that are pricing in cuts for the back half of this year. Again, that's what we see on the Bloomberg Terminal, the futures market.
Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, what do you make of that in 30 seconds?
Like I said, that's why I'm nervous about your saying that soft landing is still the dominant scenario. If we need to cut rates the way the market currently implies before the end of the year, that implies a landing that is somewhat hard.
Yep.
And obviously there's a risk of that, and a banking crisis would deliver that. Still not clear to me that we have as serious a banking crisis as some think.
All right. Very, very good. As always, we got Marcus Ashworth. We got John Authors. We got the Euro and UK cover. That's how I like to think about it. John Authors, thanks so much for joining us here from Bloomberg Opinion. He works on the markets team, does all that kind of great stuff. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So he gets that gold star for showing up as opposed to phoning it in.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.